Okay, it's June 18th, 2009. I'm here with Phoebe Jacobs at 325 East 79th Street. Phoebe, tell me where you were born, when you were born, and something about your parents, your early childhood.
I was born at 1301 Hoe Avenue, that's in the Bronx, on a kitchen table, apartment 5B on the fifth floor walk-up. My mother gave birth to me on a kitchen table because she was afraid to go to the hospital. She had heard that they give you the wrong baby after you give birth. And she didn't want to lose a gorgeous child. My mother's maiden name was Beatrice Watkins. She was one of 12 children, the youngest of 12 children, born in America. Very dynamic woman, very positive and strong. And my father's name was Hyman Pincus. He was originally an apprentice diamond cutter and then a diamond setter and eventually became a bootlegger and a gambler. Very suave, very charming. A Jewish Fred Astaire. Well, extremely well-dressed. Like, he played golf like baseball. He hit the ball and run. And he was a dynamite man. I was madly in love with him. And I was an only child.
What's your birthday?
June 21st, 1918.
So you got a birthday coming up in a
couple
days.
Sunday is a birthday.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so you were born on the kitchen table, and you grew up on Hoe Avenue in the South Bronx.
Oh, I lived in
the,
we lived on Hoe Avenue until I was about 5 years old. And from Hoe Avenue, we moved to Walton Place, 1478 Walton Avenue.
Walton Avenue.
In the West Bronx, I guess.
Yeah, that's near the concourse, runs parallel to the concourse.
Yeah, so my mother enrolled me in PS 64. Which was a school about a block away from where we lived. And I guess we lived there for several years because when I was about in 1929, I guess it was around the financial situation, catastrophes that occurred, my mother decided that she wants to live in Manhattan. She wanted me to have a better room and go to a private school. My father was doing extremely well, so she took an apartment on 95th Street and Riverside Drive, 230 Riverside Drive, apartment 10E. And I had my room overlooking the Hudson River and the railroad yards because there was no West Side Highway in those days. It was only freight trains. They took the apartment when the building only had two floors. My father used to sleep all day and work all night. So when he got up the first morning in the apartment, he heard chickens. And he said, "Where the hell are we living?" And we looked out the window, and there was a freight train loaded with chickens.
So you were on the second floor of the building?
Tenth floor. Yes.
And you saw the chickens on the...
Yeah, we heard and saw the chickens, and we used to watch the freight trains after that, and then we watched the West Side Highway being built.
Now, did you... So you were 9 or 10 years old,
something like that,
at that time. What school did you go to when you moved to Manhattan?
Well, my mother enrolled me in Dalton... an ethical culture. I'm sorry. My grandchildren went to Dalton. Ethical culture. And I was there 3 days, and my mother found out that we had a lesson in the park naked.
We had a lesson
in hygiene. And the teacher made us take us all his clothes off. And we were sitting naked.
In Central Park?
When I came home and I said, "Ma, why don't I have a birdie?" Next day I didn't go to that school.
You're out.
So my father got the chauffeur. We had a car and chauffeur because my mother said she's got to go back to PS 64. She has her friends there. She loves the school. We moved down here. You wanted to be a big shot. We got to get her to that school. So we got back to PS 64, and the chauffeur used to take me every day to school. And I was embarrassed to get out of the car, so they used to leave me off 2 blocks away at the delicatessen, and I used to walk to the school.
Now, at that time, your father was a diamond cutter?
No, at that time, my father was involved with a man called Ben Greenberg, who had a brewery in Jersey, and he was involved with some guys from an S&J syndicate, S&G, the Jews and the Italians were having some problems in New York. And I remember that I came to school one day, and a girl said to me, "Oh, your father's picture is on the front page of the Daily News." And I became rigid. I was so disturbed about this. And I, sure enough, I see my father, and it says, "Wanted, missing, desperate criminal, some terrible things." And I came home with the paper, and my father was in the bed. Uh-huh. And I showed it to my father, and my father found out, you know, realized what it was about, and he went immediately to the police, and I went with him. Uh-huh. And I was about 12 years old. Uh-huh. And he kept saying, "Go home, go home." And I kept running after him, "Daddy, Daddy, please let me come, please let me." And I finally went in with my father while he, you know, he said whatever they wanted to know, he'd be willing. They were looking for, a Scattergory killing or something. Some congressman was molested by some mobsters. Mm-hmm. And he had been seen in Dinty Moore's or a restaurant or something with these people. But they used to play klabiash, which I understood was some kind of a crazy Hungarian game that he knew quite well, and he was a card shark. So he had been socializing with these people, and somebody identified him as one of the men who was the last man to see this guy that was molested. But he was available for a questioning. Mm-hmm. Now, this case was obviously a very hot case about this Scattergory stuff in Harlem, because I do remember very well that I went to Saratoga with my father, and he took this woman, Doris Coppola, I think her name, and her husband was Mikey Coppola. And my father had a piece of a club in Saratoga Springs called the Arrowhead Inn.
Arrowhead Inn. Mm-hmm.
It was a very high-class gambling casino, and Franklin Roosevelt was governor at the time and used to come there. And we had a house on Union Avenue in Saratoga, right next to Samuel Rossoff, who was the subway tycoon.
Now, did your father go up for the racing season? Is that where you went up in August?
August we used to go. But this particular time that we went up, my father took Doris Coppola. Mikey had asked him to take his wife out of New York so she would not be molested by the police in questioning her about the Scattergory situation. She was pregnant and she was very hysterical, and he trusted my father, and he felt he was, and that was the time of the Jewish, as I said, the S&G was Italians and Jews. I think S&G stood for something. One's Italian name and
yeah, what was it, a company or
no? S&G was the newspapers, I guess, coined the title because it represented the Italians and the Jews who were having conflict over territories. I don't know whether it was about beer or whiskey. I don't remember the details of it, but I know that Max Greenberg, this guy I told you about that had the brewery in Jersey, was a partner and associate with a man called Longie Zwillman. This Max Greenberg, I think, was shot in the Park Sheridan Hotel barbershop.
That's where Albert Anastasia was shot.
It was a famous barbershop in the Park Sheridan Hotel. Yeah. Park Central was then.
Yeah.
And the guys used to go there to like have a meeting, and then there was Lindy's right near there where they used to go to eat. So why did I tell you about...
So you were talking about, at that time, your father took you to the... You went along with him when he cleared his name.
Right,
and
right.
The S&G was
a... Right, and I'm trying to figure out how did this syndicate that they called S&G, how did it come about? I think it might have come about from Walter Winchell, or one of the columnists, mm-hmm. but that's how they became identified. Every time they would tell different pieces of this story... Mm-hmm. As I remember it correctly, I think it was fighting over territories and power. Mm-hmm. That was the Italians and the Jews.
Yeah. So at that time, you were still living at 230 Riverside.
Yes, I was.
And you were teenager?
Yes, I was.
And how long did you live at the 230 Riverside?
Until about, this was about 17, 18 years old when we moved to the Bronx.
Moved back to the Bronx?
Back to the West Bronx on someplace on 170th Street off Jerome Avenue. Mm-hmm. McCombs Road.
Uh-huh.
McCombs Road.
And what were the reason
we moved there, well, my mother had a sister that she was very close to, Aunt Mary, and I was very close because my mother had been run over when I was 5 years old. And she had been in a hospital on and off for a year. And I had to go live with my aunt because my mother wasn't at home, and she didn't want just a servant to take care of me. So she had me go live in Aunt Mary's house, and Aunt Mary raised me that year and used to take me to school. Uncle Morris would get up, her husband, and take me to the school and pick me up every day. And so when Aunt Mary got sick and something happened with my father, he was having problems, we moved to the Bronx.
Okay.
And we moved a block away from Aunt Mary.
So you were a teenager then?
Yes, I was a teenager.
Did you go
to... I was 16 because I remember having a sweet 16 party, yes.
Did you go to high school in the Bronx?
No, I went to Julia Richmond High.
Julia Richmond.
Yeah, it was an all-girls school. That's why I remember.
That was on the West End Avenue?
No, it was not. It was on 2nd Avenue. It's still there.
Oh, yeah.
68th Street.
Yeah, it's where I think the FBI occupies that building now.
Right. I don't know.
So, and that was a girls' high school?
Oh, all girls. That's why my mother sent me. I wasn't allowed to be out after 11 o'clock. I couldn't wear high heels and lipstick like the rest of the girls. I used to go to my girlfriend's house. I could smoke and put on lipstick and high heels because that's what I wanted.
Now, before you moved to the Bronx, you were living at Riverside Drive.
Right.
What's across street, 99th?
95th Street.
95th Street. Mm-hmm. Tell me what that neighborhood was like.
Oh, my God, it was posh. First of all, we lived in what was the only new building. The Paris Hotel was on West End Avenue.
And 97th Street.
96th
and 97th,
yeah.
Yeah.
And, the Paris Hotel was on 95th Street.
No, 97th. I'm pretty sure. In any event, these I can check.
Well, what was the one on 95th Street?
95th Street was another one. It's now part of the...
Old age home, like a retirement
it's,
home.
It's Salvation Army old age home. A cousin of mine was living there.
And, of course, I used to go to the Thalia Theater on 95th Street.
Yeah.
And Symphony Space was another movie. And on 96th Street, there were four movie houses and... what did they call them? Not open air, where you could go to a movie house and sit out.
You mean like a drive-in? No.
No. On the roof, a roof garden.
A roof garden.
Yeah.
So up and was that just as an entertainment thing, or did they have...
Movies. Yeah, I saw Flying Down to Rio there, and, you know, pictures of Public Enemy.
Yeah.
James Cagney. Yeah, there was the... I forget the name of the movie houses, but I go there all the time.
Now, did your parents go out to eat in that neighborhood?
Oh, of course. There was Pomerance's was a restaurant on 95th Street. We went to Schraff's on 84th, and there was a Jewish delicatessen someplace right across the street.
Was the Tiptoe Inn there?
Tiptoe Inn was there. A Garden Bakery. Wonderful Chinese restaurants, good shops, lovely places. There were places that made custom-made hats for ladies and custom-made clothes and furriers that would, you know, they were all wonderful craftspeople in the neighborhood.
Yeah. So you then moved to the Bronx. You were a teenager, and you commuted back to Julia Richmond.
Yeah.
Did you take the subway? How did you get back?
Subway. Used to meet my girlfriend on the station. We'd go together.
Uh-huh.
I'm still friends with her.
Oh, isn't that wonderful?
Yeah.
So after you finished high school, you were still living on McCombs Place.
Uh-huh, right.
And
McCombs Road.
McCombs Road. And McCombs Dam Park is where the Yankee Stadium is.
Right.
Were you a Yankee fan?
I was.
What did you do after high school?
I enrolled in NYU. But during the summer at high school, my best friend's uncle was a the evening gown manufacturer, 530 Fifth Avenue. His name was Stanley Kallman, K-A-L-L-M-A-N. Uh-huh. And he had Kallmore Gowns. Kallman and Morris was the name of his firm. In fact, I used to do the switchboard. I had a job there, you know, like helping out in the summertime. Mm-hmm. He gave his niece, Leona, and myself a job.
Let's see if we can figure out what year that was. That was in the 30s.
Yeah, it was 31, I think.
31.
30 or 31. So, yeah,
the Depression was already on.
And one of the models was June Havoc, Gypsy uh-huh. Rose Lee's sister.
Uh-huh.
And his designer was Ted, who became a very famous designer in California and worked with, I know it was Don Lopa, who was his designer, mm-hmm. who worked with Kay Thompson, Lady Ears in California. And one day he come over and I'm at the switchboard and he says to me, come inside, I need somebody, I need a body. Naturally, I got up and I plugged in the board and I went and he made me take off my blouse and he starts pinning fabric on me. But he's a queer. I don't know whether he's a queer or not, but I'm standing there and I'm shivering and sweating and he's pinning and he puts on this strapless evening gown and made it on me.
Mm-hmm.
And he pushes me out in the showroom. I don't remember who was there, the buyers, whatever, but they bought the gown.
Yeah.
The gown was really, because the fabric was magnificent. And her uncle says to me, tomorrow you come and you're going to be a model.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, what does a model do? I didn't know what to do. I was just scared to tell my mother because my mother and father wouldn't stand for it. I should get undressed.
Yeah.
But that's what I did for the next month.
Uh-huh.
And then I became very friendly with June Havoc. She taught me mm-hmm. what to do. Mm-hmm. You know. And she took me to see her sister in the burlesque house.
Where was it?
42nd Street, yeah. Minsky's.
Minsky's had a place on 42nd
Street. 2nd Street, mm-hmm. yeah.
And so then you were at NYU.
Yeah, but I quit.
Okay.
I didn't want to continue. Because I started to go out with a guy, and I decided that I want to get married.
Okay.
Because this is the only way I can get out of my house.
So tell me about the guy.
Somebody took me to a dance. My girlfriend, Leona, went to Europe with her mother and her boyfriend.
Uh-huh.
Her mother was a widow, and she had a rich boyfriend, Shagas, who was the CEO of General Electric Maritime Division mm-hmm. Refrigerated Components. So we used to put refrigeration in steamships mm-hmm. that sailed the ocean. Mm-hmm. So when Leona was 16, he took her to Europe. And when she came back, and of course we were very close mm-hmm. because we were like sisters. She was an only child, so was I. Back when she got a soul kiss, she told me she was pregnant. I said, how do you know? She said, he stuck his tongue in my mouth. So we were worried about when she was going to give birth. So when she came back from Europe, I heard all about the shipboard romance with the West Point cadet.
Mm-hmm.
And she was carrying the torch because her mother wouldn't allow her with the Shagas to go with the Shagas. And it was a terrible scene. So I got an invitation to a dance in a place called the Tabs on East Tremont Avenue. And I said, Leona, we're going to a dance Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
I said, come on, we'll go. We'll have a little fun. We both loved to Lindy.
Mm-hmm.
So we went to this dance, and at the dance, this guy that looked like Tyrone Power, he loved Leona because she's a double D cup bra. So she was quite the girl. She was also very attractive. So he picked her, and I picked the guy that was playing the piano, or he picked me, and we danced, and they took us home. What happened eventually was that the guy that Tyrone Power liked me mm-hmm. after the first two or three dates that we had, and he was romancing me, and he had a big car, mm-hmm. and he was the best looking, and all the girls wanted him. So I talked them into getting married.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, how they want to know how a guy proposed. You run after him until you catch him, right? So when I told my father and mother I wanted to get married, naturally I couldn't get married like any other Jewish girl would in a nice temple or whatever. My father hired the Grand Ballroom of the New Yorker Hotel, which is
the New Yorker on 34th.
Yeah, Benny Goodman was playing there, and Benny Goodman was my favorite band leader.
Now, what was the name of your husband?
Carl Ostrow, O-S-T-R-O-W.
Mm-hmm.
And he was an amateur golfer, excellent golfer. He was a lifeguard that time at Jones's Beach.
Mm-hmm.
He was a son of a lady that had four children, and he was in the retail automotive business, like Strauss stores would be. He had a name for his, I forget. The store was on 2nd Avenue and 9th Street.
9th? Uh-huh.
Next to a funeral parlor.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the first New Year's Eve I was married to him, he said, "We're invited to a party." I'm married to the man, he's going to take me to a party New Year's Eve. I don't ask where did we go? To the funeral home. And they put all the champagne in where they had the bodies, and we were having a party in the funeral home. And I was so depressed, I couldn't wait to get out of there. But these were his friends, and that's where they made the party. The band was playing. I expect any minute they were going to put a stiff up.
But you wound up getting married at the New Yorker Hotel.
New Yorker Hotel, and when? We went to on our honeymoon on the SS Lafayette to Havana.
Havana. Now, what year was that?
1932, I think.
You got married in 32 or 33?
Yeah, well, let's figure. If I was 18, I was born in 1918, how old was I?
Well, 18 and 18 would be 36. So at 36, how old were you when you got married? Do you remember?
18 or 19.
Okay, so it was 1935, 36, somewhere in there.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And we went to
Havana.
And we took an apartment, 55 East 174th Street, mm-hmm. 2.5-room apartment, $52 a month.
Now, 52 East 174th
yes.
is in Washington Heights,
no,
or was it in the Bronx?
In the Bronx,
okay.
Was right off Mount Eden Avenue.
Uh-huh. And how much did you pay?
Moscow Delva Kesten I used to go to. $52 a month
uh-huh.
was our
For
rent.
How big was the apartment?
2.5 rooms.
Uh-huh.
And my mother took me to Grossfeld House, which was a very fine interior designer that had furniture in Best in Company, in B. Altman's mm-hmm. and John Wanamaker's.
Uh-huh.
In fact, those two tables I still have.
Isn't that wonderful?
From Grossfeld House.
Where was it located?
Grossfeld House was somewhere, I guess, in the 30s with the furniture district.
Uh-huh.
You had to have a decorator
yeah.
to take you there. And, actually my family bought me a lovely, I had a baby grand piano from Riverside Drive.
And did you play the piano?
Yes, I played the piano. Played, like my mother used to say, let's hear the $10,000 piece if you figure out how much the piano lessons cost on the piano. But I played terrible, like with two thumbs.
Yeah.
But I played it for my mother and father's enjoyment.
That's good.
Yeah.
So you're now married. Your husband has the auto parts place,
right,
and
right.
you're living.
I married April 3rd.
April 3rd, and we think it was 36.
I think it was 35.
35. So how did that go? You were married now.
I was married, and February 21st of 36, I gave birth to my child.
Uh-huh.
So let's figure it back. January. December, November, October, September, August, July, June, May.
So you didn't waste any time.
Right. I was not careless.
Was it a boy or a girl?
A boy. My son, Jerome, was born.
Mm-hmm. And what day was he born?
Was February 21st, 1936.
Uh-huh.
Right. In Wickersham Hospital.
Uh-huh.
Dr. Samuel L. Jacobs delivered him.
Uh-huh.
He was recommended to me by my mother's physician because mm-hmm. my mother's legs were saved when she had her automobile accident, and she just loved her doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Samuel Jacobs was a divine man. He was notorious for performing abortions,
uh-huh.
but he also was an obstetrician and gynecologist. So he was also famous for delivering children very well.
So now, did you stay at home when you had the baby? Or were
oh,
you
yes. No, I stayed at home, took care of the baby.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother lived on Townsend Avenue. I lived on East 174th Street. So I used to wheel over to my mother every day.
Mm-hmm.
I had her.
Uh-huh.
I had a grandchild.
So how long did you live on East 174th Street?
Until my son was about 5 for. Mm-hmm. No, and I had to get a room. I only had 2.5 rooms. Yeah. Yeah. And I had to get a bigger apartment. Mm-hmm. And my father helped Carl get more stores. Mm-hmm. So he was doing better. And everybody was moving to Forest Hills. So we moved to Forest Hills, where I got a 4.5 room apartment, which, in other words, was 2 bedrooms and 2 baths. Mm-hmm.
What was the rent there?
I think $90, $89.
Mm-hmm. So that was in...
411. 411 was the number of the building. My son would know, because he was always telling me...
Was it a street or an avenue? Austin Street? No.
No, it wasn't Austin.
You'll think about legal blank. Yeah. You'll think of it. So you moved there. You were married. You had a son.
Uh-huh.
And he was 4 or 5 years old. You moved to a bigger apartment. He went to public...
Well, don't forget I had my daughter then, 2 years later.
Oh, okay. That
Susie was born February 19th, 1938.
Uh-huh.
Or 1939.
Okay, so you now had two kids.
I have two
kids. The husband's business is doing pretty good because he's picking up
some
stores.
He's very busy with his golf because he was an amateur champ. Uh-huh. He could have been a professional.
Yeah. Where did he play golf? Van Cortlandt Park? Or?
Oh, any place he was invited, because he used to be invited to play golf by some very good golfers. He was dynamite.
Yeah.
And he loved to go fishing with his friend Ben Gelber, who owned a boat. And I guess Ben was the kind of guy that always had extra afternoon sessions, you know, even though his wife was a dynamite girl. But in those days, whoever knew about it. But he, when he made a pass at me, I knew that something was going on with this guy. So at the minute my daughter was born, before my daughter was born, I guess, or maybe when I was pregnant with my daughter, I suddenly had a very distaste for my husband. Mm-hmm. I couldn't bear him. Mm-hmm. I mean, just him swallowing food or sitting opposite me and eating, I would cringe. Mm-hmm. I had no respect for him. Mm-hmm. To me, he was. I could compare him to what black people told me pimps were like. Mm-hmm. When I'd say, Carl, I believe we should get some furniture for the kids. I can't keep Susie in a crib. Mm-hmm. She's getting me. Well, why don't you ask your father? Mm-hmm. Carl, I think the kids should go to camp. It's summer, you know, we're not going any place in the heat, whatever. Mm-hmm. Well, ask your mother and father. They'll send the kids to camp. And that's the way a marriage was.
So the marriage was on the way out?
As far as I was concerned. Yeah. And of course, I had a circle of friends, and we would get pretty intimate. And, you know, I got to understand a lot of different things. One summer, I went to the beach with this girl that I grew up with, Leona, which I'm still friendly with. And
what beach did you go to?
We used to go to Deal, New Jersey. Mm-hmm. There was a Hollywood Hotel owned by the Sidons, because my mother used to go to the Sidons in Lido and Palm Beach.
Yeah.
But I couldn't, Carl couldn't afford that, so I'd stay across the street. There was a place where the women used to rent 2 or 3 rooms, and I would then go over to Hollywood for my meals. And the Leona, she was having trouble with Dave. He would not show up, or she found out that he was in New York dancing here or there. That was going on. Then my other friend Doris was... So we were all in the same kind of thing, where all the marriages were falling apart. And
this was before the war still.
No,
38, 39?
No, wait a minute now. This was the time that... I think the war was just starting.
So it wouldn't be 41, maybe 42.
Yeah, because... I remember Carl was deferred because of his physical. He had something with his ear. Mm-hmm. I believe that's why. But also, Sam Craver, who was Lou's Carl's associate in the retail store, he was getting army surplus stuff that they were selling.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess it was just around that time.
Yeah, because if your daughter was born in 38?
Yeah.
Okay, so the you had problems before she was born, but after they got worse, so it was 2 or 3 more years you were still married.
I was still married, but I was only married in name.
Okay.
I couldn't stand him.
So the war came.
I tell my mother, I don't want to live with him. Was he cheating on you? Mm-hmm. So I said, of course you should look the other way. Mm-hmm. He still misses. What are you going to do? Ma, I wish you would cheat. I'd be thrilled to death. I don't want any part of him. She said, well, if you leave him, you're leaving me too, because your father and I are going to disown you. Mm-hmm. He's a good man, mm-hmm. and we don't want you to do any such thing. Mm-hmm. So I thought to myself, well, it was an agonizing situation. I had Bessie Flowers, a housekeeper that I had employed, that I got through my mother. My children adored her. She was wonderful. My girlfriend Helen became vice president of Simon & Schuster because of the war.
What was her last name?
Barrow, B-A-R-R-O-W. She worked for a guy called Tommy Bevins, who was one of the chief editors at Simon & Schuster. Mm-hmm. He was inducted in the Army. She was raised to being executive mm-hmm. of production. And I used to do her homework. She used to bring home things for me. It started off, she brought home crossword puzzles. Mm-hmm. And I used to take the black pen and fill up the squares. Mm-hmm. That was my job. They since made a machine to do that. But in those days, that's what I did. And I decided to learn. At night, I went to school and learned shorthand and typing. And I decided, so I told Carl, he's got to go. I'm going to change the lock on the door. I don't care what, but he's got to leave. And with that, my son was going to be my misfit. Mm-hmm. Oh, that was the straw that broke the dominoes. When my son was going to be my misfit, and he told me to go to my father mm-hmm. to make the bar mitzvah.
Mm-hmm. Where was the bar mitzvah? In the concourse?
In the temple on Queens Boulevard.
Oh, that's right. You were in Forest Hills by then. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. 4611 65th Road, I think is where we lived it wasn't Forest Hills, I
Kew
think.
Kew Gardens?
No, they called it East, no.
Regal Park?
Regal Park, that's what they called it.
Yeah, I'm in New York,
right,
too.
Oh, boy. Because I remember Susie got a job in Alexander's then.
Yeah. But your son was about to be bar mitzvahed, and you said, I'm changing the locks on the doors.
And I got rid of him.
Mm-hmm.
One guy had been after me while I was married, because a couple of times I would be very discontented, and one of my friends who was single used to be a rumba queen. She'd take me to the Palladium Ballroom on Wednesday nights, you know.
Where was the Palladium?
Palladium in New York on 54th Street,
54th,
I guess.
55th. Is that where Roseland is?
Gee, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I got to ask somebody.
It was
somebody.
Over near Broadway.
Yeah, Broadway. Right. I'll ask somebody that knows. But anyway, I used to go every Wednesday night to the Palladium. I won a cha-cha contest and a rumba contest a weekend in Havana. And I loved to dance. And Teddy is telling me, Saturday afternoon, there's a rumba matinee. Teddy was my single friend that I met. How did I meet Teddy? Oh, I met her when I was a model.
Uh-huh.
She was June Havoc's roommate.
Oh, Teddy's a girl.
Teddy, her name was Theodore Bly.
Uh-huh.
Her father was a doctor in Monticello,
uh-huh.
and they moved to New York, and she owned a mansion on Grand Concourse,
uh-huh.
one of these marvelous yeah. old houses, old
yeah.
Victorian
yeah.
mansion, and she was a model. She was, her boyfriend owned McGinnis's restaurant on Broadway and 48th Street,
mm-hmm.
and she was also a dance queen. So she tells me, I met a guy who's so hot for you, it's unbelievable. You've got to meet him. And I said, look, honey, I'm a married, you know, I wasn't that sophisticated. Now it would have been nothing. I mean, later years, but those days I was really goody-two-shoes. She called me from Florida. She said, I'm here, and you'll never guess who I'm with. Not this guy, Matt, that I told you about that's mad for you. He took me out, and he bought me the most gorgeous pocketbook for $100. I mean, $100 for a pocketbook in those days was something.
Yeah.
But I promised him that you'd have lunch with him when we come back. Promised me that we can have a date.
Mm-hmm.
So we made a date to go to to La Martinique for Saturday afternoon rummer matinee, and I told my mother about it.
Now, this was, you were separated or divorced? Or are you still married?
No, I was separated.
You were separated.
I was separated, working on a divorce.
So I was thinking of the dates, because if your son was born at 36, that means he was bar mitzvahed in 49. Okay, 13 years after.
Yeah.
So it was after the war. You must have stayed married during the war.
I was a volunteer for the USO, and I drove an ambulance.
Okay, this was all during the war.
Yeah.
Yeah. So after the war is really when the marriage ran into big problems.
And when I went to this, why I'm bringing Mac into it is when I knew Mac, and he was in the whiskey business.
Uh-huh.
And through Mac, when we had that luncheon date, my mother met him. She thought he was such a nice man, which he was. He was a darling.
Did your mother and father forgive you?
Oh, yes, eventually.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they would love the children.
Yeah.
And then my mother and father were divorcing.
Uh-huh.
They were having their problems. So what happened is that there was a purpose. I wanted to tell you this.
You're telling me about the Mac.
So Mac had a friend, Mo, who wanted, heard we were having, you know, we used to go out every Saturday afternoon, that he wanted to be part of the act.
Uh-huh.
So this girl, Doris, that I knew who was having this big problem with her husband,
uh-huh.
and she was already separated from
yeah.
him, but it was on a temporary thing.
Yeah.
You know, he was living home, but
yeah.
they were
yeah.
getting whatever. So I said, why don't you come and meet Mo? And so we made a foursome. Mo had a liquor store. So when my kid was bar mitzvahed, and they knew I had the bar mitzvah, these two men sent all the wine and all the whiskey to the temple
mm-hmm.
and never sent me a bill.
Uh-huh.
That's why I remember
yeah.
thinking about them. And they were my friends till they died.
Mm-hmm.
They were wonderful gentlemen.
Let me stop for 1 second. Okay, so you were talking about the Mo and Mac who became your friends for their whole life.
My whole life.
Okay, so now you got divorced, probably late 40s, early 50s.
Yeah.
The kids were getting older. They were growing up.
Sure.
Where did your son go to high school? In Forest Hills?
Put him in private school, Columbia Grammar.
Mm-hmm. And your daughter?
By that time, I moved up to Scarsdale, where my mother lived. And my daughter went to Scarsdale High.
Okay, so after, in the early 50s, you moved from...
Well, I married.
Ah, okay. Well, that's the detail we didn't
realize. One of the, my girlfriend Leona, the one I told you that I grew up with, that I'm still friends mm-hmm. with, she belonged to a club in New Jersey called, with an A, yeah.
In Deal or down that on Jersey Shore?
Across the street in George Washington Bridge
uh-huh.
was a golf club. Ardsley, not Ardsley. Mm-hmm.
Demarest? I don't know.
No, something with an A.
Arthur would know.
Well,
he's a golfer.
Oh, really? Anyway, she belonged to this club, and this guy was divorced, and she said, oh, God, did I meet a guy for you? He loves to dance. He's a sport. He's got a big dress manufacturing business. He was the father of two kids. He saw you with this and this affair, and blah, 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 blah. And so they fixed me up with him. And I got the rush from him. So I introduced him. I brought him up to my mother's house, and he came up with his car and chauffeur, because his father was a very big shot in the garment center.
Uh-huh.
Schaffman. They had cotton club dresses. They did the swirl house dresses for $3.95. Multi-million-dollar manufacturers,
yeah.
big shots. His father was head of the Jewish temple on West End Avenue, and his brother was head of the Baptist Cavalry Church.
Uh-huh.
His brother became a Baptist.
Uh-huh.
But Milton was...
his name, Milton?
Milton Schaffman, S-C-H-A-R-F-M-A-N.
Uh-huh.
And he was worked with his father. Dynamite gentleman, very, very intelligent, very bright. In fact, Dave Carr, Leona's husband, took him to Chicago And he was there on an insurance festival or some kind of get-together. And he says to Milton, I'm going to pass you off as an insurance expert. Because he was fascinated by Milton's memory, how he could remember cards when they played bridge. He could tell you almost what you had in your hand.
Yeah.
So he gave Milton some stuff, and he introduced him as an authority, and all the big shots were around. That was Milton's mind. Yeah. He was unreal. Yeah. I brought him to my mother. He showed up with his father's car and chauffeur and took my mother and her husband, my mother was then remarried, to the Ben Mons Riviera, of course, in New Jersey.
Uh-huh. What was it called?
Ben Martin's Riviera.
Ben Martin's Riviera.
Right next to the George Washington Bridge. And Jerry Lewis and Dean Martin were featured there.
Okay, I'm going to stop for 1 second. When I stop, it's just because I want to talk, but I don't want it to be on the recording. Two things. My grandmother, my mother died when I was young, but my father married again when he was in his 60s. Married a woman from Steubenville, Ohio. That's where Dean Martin was from. Mm-hmm. She was Jewish, German Jewish. And my father was the boxing commissioner in New York, and they had a big fight out in Las Vegas, 1960, 61. Mm-hmm. They go to the fight, but before the fight, they go to the nightclub, the Desert Inn. Uh-huh. And the pit boss at the Desert Inn was a guy named Corny Jones, C.J. Jones, who was from Steubenville, Ohio. And Helen, my stepmother's parents, had put him put the brothers through medical school, and this guy was a gambler. He was the pit boss at the Desert Inn. So they go to the show, and who's in the show but Dean Martin? You know,
So
after the show was over, somebody yells to Dean Martin, come over here at this table, I got a lanceman of yours. And that was my stepmother. And he said to her, what was your maiden name? And she said, Sulzbacher. And his eyes lit up. His father had a department store. He says, many of the things I've clipped from that store when I was a kid.
isn't that
a good one? But let me ask you something else. My father was born in 1895. And during the period of time that there was the Prohibition, he used to go, and I think it was in Jersey, to a place called Ben Nardi's. Did you ever hear that? Or something Nardi's? Because he always confused that name with something else. But anyway, okay.
The only place I knew was Ben Martin.
Okay, so Martin.
M-A-R-D-E-N.
That's the place he talked about.
Ben Martin Riviera. It had been a speakeasy originally.
Okay, wait a second. Let me turn it back on. Okay, it was off for a few minutes, so we may have to go back and...
Right. My Uncle Zig, who got me this apartment, in 1958, I think, I got this apartment. My uncle lived in this building on the fourth floor. Mm-hmm. In fact, this building now has 80 apartments. When my uncle moved here, there was 40.
Yeah,
and I'm living in the servants' quarters. So my uncle said, Phoebe, you know Harry Rosenblum. He's going to a function at the Waldorf Astoria and needs a date. Why don't you go with him? You like Harry. I loved Harry. He was an up guy, good sense of humor.
But this was still, Jacobs was on the back.
Oh, yeah, Jacobs was always there. He knew all about my dates and everything else. So Harry calls me and he says, you want to go with me to this thing? I said, I didn't come dressed. I mean, he said, what are you worrying about? I'll get you something. A big box comes with a silver fox stole and a black strapless dress and a beaded bag. I mean, he knew how to get women's clothes, honey. This guy was... He built the Virgin Island Hilton Hotel.
Uh-huh.
Harry had a rum business in the Virgin Islands. So we went out, and he had a house in across the street from the diet doctor that was killed.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he lived right across the street from that diet. He had a estate there with a tennis court and stables and a guest cottage.
Yeah, it was in Westchester.
I forget the address. And so Harry's sons and my kids, and he'd come over to my house in Scarsdale or wherever I was, and we'd go out together, and I dug him. And then one day he says, look, let's come on down to the Virgin Islands. I'm building a house somewhere. It's going to be for you. Mm-hmm. I know you love the Virgin Islands.
Mm-hmm.
Because I told him I made a will, and I want my heirs to spring to Kalia Bay. I said, I'd love to go for the weekend.
Mm-hmm.
So I went down to Virgin Islands, and he proposed to me, gave me a ring on the plane, and I wrote Lou a letter that I'm going to be married. And he's been wonderful, and he's been full of my life, and this is just the greatest. Mm-hmm. My kids love him. Yeah. My family, we know he's my family. I know him.
Yeah.
And when his wife died, he kept her mother.
Mm-hmm.
And he, you know, I mean, he was that kind of a human being.
Yeah.
So I'm in the Virgin Islands, and Harry is asking me to go furnish the house. So I walk around, and I'm on the main street, and I see a Jeep coming towards me, you know, and you're on Main Street in the Virgin Islands, you see everybody,
mm-hmm.
and this man with a suit and a felt hat in this broiling sun. I take a look, a double take, it's Lou. I don't know what to do. And I said, when the car stops, and I said, Lou, what are you doing here? He said, I got your letter. I want to make sure I can meet this guy. Because I, you know, I wanted to make sure I could catch the pieces if something happens.
Mm-hmm.
So where are you staying? He said, the Virgin Island Hilton, and I expect you and Harry to come over and have dinner.
Mm-hmm.
So that night, when I got home, I told Harry. So Harry says, you're good. That was your old boyfriend. He says, go with him. I don't have to be there. I said, Harry, I want you to meet him. Well, he got jealous and mad and annoyed, and he started to drink. And we went anyway. And when we got there, I had two martinis.
Mm-hmm.
Do I have to tell you anything else? So between the two martinis and he getting high, I took up the ring. I gave him back the ring. I told Lou to go drop dead. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I was ugly and evil and mean and rotten. And I had had the two of them. And I called when I got back to the house to get a ticket to go home. And what happened is that before I left, I had booked Duke Ellington into the Virgin Islands,
mm-hmm.
a concert at St. Thomas, and one in St. Croix, and one in Puerto Rico. And it was my plan to go from St. Thomas to St. Croix to meet mm-hmm. Duke Ellington there the next
mm-hmm.
day. So I figured I'll go home from St. Croix because the band will probably be going, or they'll be going home from Puerto Rico. At least I won't be by myself because I was so depressed.
Mm-hmm.
So when I get to St. Croix, who's in St. Croix but Lou Jacobs? He found out where I was going. And he said, now look, he said, come on, we'll have a good time together and get over it. I mean, Harry's a very nice guy. Give him another chance. He couldn't handle it. You know, Harry said, I'm younger. He said to me in front of Lou, Lou is more for you. He's young. He's vibrant. He's never been married. He has no excess baggage. I got two sons. I got an ex-mother-in-law, whatever. Harry was very dear. He was a classy man. I was very lucky to know him. So when we're in St. Croix, we go to the Duke Ellington thing, and Duke knew Lou from Basin Street because he used to come to the music all the time. So Lou says, Duke says, what do you say, kids? Why don't you get married? I'll play at your wedding. So Lou says, I'm ready. She don't want to get married. She don't want me. So I said, Lou, don't ever say that. I didn't want you. I said, you never made any overtures that you exactly wanted to take on the responsibilities of a family.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you have your mother and your father and your sister, mm-hmm. and you seem very happy the way you are. I want somebody who wants us. Mm-hmm. I need somebody that is going to care for us.
Mm-hmm.
I'm tired.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, I was very close to Peggy Lee, and I was speaking to Peggy, and she says, the hell with all of them. Just come out here, will you? And I'll get you in a lot of trouble, and we'll have some fun. I loved Peggy. She was a dreamboat. My son was going with her niece at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So, Duke working on Lou. When we get to Puerto Rico, he says, okay, I'll try to get your marriage license right here. Then you had to wait 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
Called my mother. My mother said to me, listen, you're coming home. Don't forget this number unless you get married. I don't care who it is.
Yeah.
You got to get yourself a guy.
Yeah.
I'm sick of it.
Yeah.
I don't know how much longer I'm going to live. I'd like to see you married already.
Mm-hmm. And so you got married.
So I came home. Leona and Dave got Sam Spiegel, who was their buddy, to marry us. Judge DeFalco got Sam Spiegel.
Mm-hmm.
And he married us. And we made a wedding dinner in two steps down an Italian restaurant. Grotto Azzurra.
Yeah, a little Italy.
Yeah.
Still there.
Yeah, that's where we had our wedding. And we never went on a honeymoon, no. What happened? Lou moved. Oh, yeah, he wanted me to move where his mother. I said, I'm never leaving Manhattan. Mm-hmm. He never moved in, but he came here. And we lived together.
And this is this building we're in
this
now?
Right here.
And
right
what
now.
Year did you move in?
I moved in here in 1956, I think.
What was the rent then?
Oh, I think $110.
Yeah.
yeah. My garage, well, when Lou came here, I think the garage was about 65.
Mm-hmm. Now, Lou was in the hardware business?
Lou had a hardware store, which was his father's.
Where was it?
In college. Well, if you were going to give New York an enema, yeah. You stick the pipe where the garage, where his business was, College Point. Okay? The sidewalk had the Jacob's name in brass letters.
Yeah.
Because his father had started there with a horse and wagon when he first came to America.
Mm-hmm.
And he was an electrician in the old country. And he and his brothers, Harry and Sam and... I forget the third mm-hmm. brother, had changed the gas lamps in Flushing mm-hmm. to street lights.
That was their
job. And they had a horse and wagon, and when he opened his store, he used to sell hardware stuff mm-hmm. on his wagon.
Mm-hmm.
But when he got a location in Queens, in College Point, they lived in back of the store.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where Lou was born.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now, you mentioned something before that I want to come back to. You were working in Basin Street.
Right.
Okay. How did you get involved in, other than listening to jazz, how did you get involved in meeting these people and representing them and doing the things you did?
Well, when I worked... Well, first of all, you got to know that in my family, we always had music. My mother went to had a subscription to the opera, a series for symphony orchestra, chamber music. In our house, we had a Victrola, we had a pianola. On Friday nights, we'd have music. Uncle Morris would scribble on the violin. My cousin Ralph would come with his saxophone. Somebody else would come with the trombone. We had another cousin with a flute. There was always music going on in the family. And the women used to sing. They were disgusting. They were awful. Nobody was talented. But we loved the music. And my mother's brother, Benny, owned a brewery, King's Beer, in Brooklyn. And his son, Ralph, played the saxophone, was my cousin, introduced me to...
What was Benny's last name?
Benny Watkins,
mm-hmm.
W-A-T-K-I-N-S. He was partners with... I forget the name, Nat. There was brothers that were his partners in King's Beer in Brooklyn
mm-hmm.
after Prohibition.
Mm-hmm.
And my cousin Ralph was in a jazz orchestra in Long Beach, and then he worked in Ben Martin's Riviera for a while and had his own band, and then he opened nightclubs.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to go over to that house, and they played Duke Ellington for me and Count Basie and all this, and that's how I learned about jazz.
Yeah.
In fact, he got me a lot of records, which my mother would never want to have in the house. And through Ralph, I was able to go and be a hat check girl when he opened Kelly's Stable because I was too young.
Where was Kelly's Stable?
On 52nd Street opposite the Hickory House.
Okay, so that was 52nd Street, was the jazz street.
Right, jazz street, and it was during wartime, and I used to go do hat check because he had Billie Holiday was his feature, which I adored her, and her piano player was Nat King Cole. He was her accompanist.
Mm-hmm.
And... I heard lots of wonderful things there. Billy Daniels, Billy Eckstein, Louis Armstrong, Benny Goodman. Then he'd take me to hear a piece of the Famous Door, and he had Count Basie there.
Where was that?
The Famous Door was down the street from Leon and Eddie's, across the street from 52nd Street. And next to the Famous Door was the Three Deuces, where he brought Errol Garner in from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. So I got exposed to all this music.
Now, you're working as a hat check girl.
Yeah, well, I was only temporary.
Yeah,
so he introduced, the first man I met involved with music was Cy Oliver.
Mm-hmm.
And Cy Oliver knew, you know, he was working at Decca Records at the time. And I said I would love to go work at the record company. And, he, you know, didn't say anything, but it was nice. We had a like, little nice rapport. Mm-hmm. But I was also working at Simon & Schuster. Mm-hmm. We were doing books. Mm-hmm. And one of the books that I was doing a paste-up on was our Rodgers and Hart songbook. Mm-hmm. And I knew about Ella Fitzgerald doing a recording of Rodgers and Hart songs. So I asked Cy Oliver if he could show Ella Fitzgerald this the artwork. Mm-hmm. Maybe we could make a deal with it. And then he got her manager, Norman Granson, so we started to talk, and he thought it was a good idea because we used to do our books in Liberty Music Shop on Madison Avenue if we did music books because mm-hmm. Simon & Schuster was such a high-class publishing. So we packaged Ella in that. So that's how I got friendly with Norman Granz, mm-hmm. although I just met Alex for hello and goodbye. Mm-hmm. So when Ralph opened Basin Street on Broadway, I started to work there at night. He had a ticket booth where he sold tickets. And it was just about I was breaking up with Milton when he had the Basin Street on Broadway, mm-hmm. because Milton worked as a bartender there, mm-hmm. and the bartender told Ralph that the guy pocketed $400. Mm-hmm. He said, "Look, I'm short. I know he's your relative, but I'm telling you what happened." So Ralph said to me, "What's with this guy?" You know, I didn't really realize then what was going on, how bad it was. So I was doing whatever jobs I could get to get myself hands on some money because he would either rob me in the morning. I'd have nothing in my pocketbook. The only thing I had was my gold wedding band on my finger. Mm-hmm. So for whatever it was worth, Ralph was offered me a steady job, which I was scared to take because nightclub business was so precarious and I had to be sure of an income. So Cy Oliver said, "I'll tell you, well, you really want to come to work for us, you can come over to Decca." Mm-hmm. So he got me a job at Decca, and in order for me to have an income, even though I was getting like $42 a week, is he made me a contractor. That meant for every record date that I could contract musicians for him, I'd make $82. Uh-huh. And he was very good to me. Mm-hmm. So he took me to the union, and you had to play an instrument, so he taught me chopsticks. I knew a little bit about the piano. Yeah. But he just said, "You just do this," and I'm telling him, "You got a boogie-woogie arrangement," or whatever. Because everybody loved Cy Oliver, and he was very well respected in music. So, you know, like a first deal, I had to contract musicians for Sammy Davis Jr. But he'd give me this list.
And you would just go to these people and...
No, I'd call them up. I said, "Are you available April 1st at 6 o'clock? We have a Sammy Davis Jr. record session." And they'd say yes or no. But he gave me all the musicians to call. Uh-huh. And he'd give me, "This is the first list you call. If he says no, this is the second, this is the third." Uh-huh. And that's the way I get it together and I get my money. Mm-hmm. So sometimes I could have record dates a day.
So, and that's also the way you got to meet all these artists.
All these artists. Get to meet somebody. Milt Gabler would say to them, "You know, whatever you need, just ask Phoebe." Mm-hmm. You know, like people would trust me.
So you said you got a wig for
Ella? She was perspiring profusely, and I said to her, "It's kind of dumb. Your hair gets straight. Why don't you try it? What do you got to lose?" You know, somebody would do that. Or, how about going to the Carnegie and get me a corned beef sandwich? Yeah. Whatever it was, I was there to do a job.
Who was her when in the early days when you met her? Who was her accompanist? Teddy Wilson? No.
No.
It was
Tommy Flanagan, I think.
I think was later. Ellis Larkin.
Oh, Ellis Larkin was the one that did the Decca recordings. You're right.
Yeah.
He was.
So you got to meet these people.
Yeah, and with Ella, it was Miss Phoebe, good afternoon, or whatever. I knew Ella Fitzgerald 10 years before she invited me to have a cup of coffee with her. I mean, Ella, don't forget, we're talking about a racist country.
Yeah.
And they don't trust anybody.
Yeah.
You can't
yeah.
blame them.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I was whitey and whatever.
Yeah.
So when I got to meet Ella on a different level, I was working at Basin Street East, and we were lucky. The doorman would drive her to the Algonquin Hotel where she had she stayed, and then he'd take me home. So this night I'm walking out with her, and she looks at her watch and she says, "You can wish me a happy birthday." So I said, "Oh, Ella, happy birthday. How wonderful. Well, tell me about a party that you had." So she said, "Party? What, are you crazy? I was never any place where I ever could have a birthday party. There weren't enough people that I knew to even invite." Mm-hmm. So when I got home, I called Ralph. It was 3 o'clock in the morning, and I said, "Ralph, it's Ella Fitzgerald's birthday." He said, "What kind of nut are you to wake me up? Go make her a party. Leave me alone. I'll see you." Bang. So I decided to make her a party, which I did. She didn't know anything about it. I wanted to get every celebrity I could get, and I knew the greatest thing I could do for her is to get a Mickey Mantle.
Mickey Mantle.
Oh, she was mad for baseball, and she loved Mickey Mantle. So I had made friends with all the concierges of all the hotels, because Basin Street was a hot place. And they would call me and say, "Phoebe," Jack would call over from the 21, "I got 50 bucks in it if you can get me a table." Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it was that kind of, you know how the yeah. clubs used to be. And I'd help all these guys out, and I'd invite them with their family. When we have
Now, were you working at Basin Street or at DECA at that time?
No, I was at Basin Street. Mm-hmm. And you know, when Ella mm-hmm. told me about her birthday. And so I called the Waldorf Towers, where I had gotten Peggy Lee an apartment the year before, and Mr. Delignese was the manager of the Waldorf Towers. And I asked Mr. Delignese if he would tell me what celebrities he has in the towers. Mm-hmm. I wanted to invite them to a surprise birthday party. Ella Fitzgerald was magic.
Yeah, big name.
So Mr. Delignese gave me the people that were there, and one of them was Richard Nixon. I invited him, and I invited who else from the war that was at the Waldorf Towers at the time. I have to think about it. Mm-hmm. But I got Johnny Hartman, who she loved.
Oh.
I got Duke Ellington and Benny Goodman and Stan Kenton and Mickey Mantle. And, it's one of the pictures up there where she's holding my arm, because I would never take a picture with a celebrity. Mm-hmm. I always stay in the background. She said, "This time you're taking a picture with me." Mm-hmm. And that's when we became friends.
Yeah.
And about 5 or 10 years later, I used to, of course, every meet her whenever she'd come to New York.
Mm-hmm.
She'd tell me when she's coming. She'd say that limousine will pick you up home, mm-hmm. come out to the airport and wait mm-hmm. for me. Mm-hmm. Then we can at least have time, because mm-hmm. she was always very busy.
Mm-hmm.
So we would talk from the airport till we got to her hotel, mm-hmm. and we'd go to eat. We'd do maybe shopping.
Mm-hmm.
We were like, you know, she wanted to know what's happened with Carl McRae. Did you see Della Reese? Does she get married to this guy? You know, what's happening with you? Who are you going out with? She'd tell me about a cop friend.
Yeah.
You know, we would be ladies.
Yeah.
We talk about things.
Yeah.
And she trusted me.
Mm-hmm.
So she has this gig at the Carnegie Hall, and it's my birthday.
Mm-hmm.
And she knows it's my birthday, and she mm-hmm. gives me 6 tickets for my family that were all in New York, because they live in California. And I'm in her dressing room helping her. And after the show, my kids come out to tell me that she stopped the show before the intermission and says, "You don't know her, but I love her, and it's her birthday." So she sang happy birthday to me, but I wasn't in the audience.
That's sweet.
She was a dreamboat. So many years later, I'm again in the... she's staying now at the Great Northern Hotel, which is... on 57th Street, down the street from Carnegie Hall.
Yeah, it's called the Meridian now, I think.
Whatever.
Yeah.
She's staying there, and I'm with her. And Don Lopa had made her these gorgeous clothes with this Chanel jacket and this beaded skirt and a little, I forget what you call the blouse that she wears underneath. And we're taken, she's going with these suits, it's stunning she lost all this weight. And intermission, she goes to change her clothes. She's got the skirt, she's got the jacket, but they left the shell in the hotel. All these people that are helping her and carrying on. So this one is...
You were talking about Ella's birthday, and after that, sang Happy Birthday at Carnegie Hall.
Oh, yeah, looking for the shell. No, that good night. Yeah. Several years later, everybody's looking to her road manager. What the hell was in there? Pete Cavella and Margaret, the dresser. And so I leave the dressing room and I run back to the hotel. Go to the desk. I got to have a key to her room. And it looks at me. I take out a $100 bill down there. And I said, look, I was just with Miss Fitzgerald. She's performing. And I got to go and get her a piece of clothing. You're going to go with me. You can call a cop. But I got to get it. And time is of the essence.
Yeah.
So I gave, the man took the $100. He takes me upstairs. And he's going to go with me to Carnegie Hall. And I get the blouse. Now, when we get to the dressing room, I said, now, look, you wait right here. I'll send somebody out from there. You know her manager. And I didn't want her to know what happened. I just brought it in. I said, oh, I just found it behind. It fell on the floor, whatever. She got dressed. I don't know how she found out about it. But as was our custom, she used to pick me up before she went to the airport. And we would drive to the airport together, and we would discuss her performance and where she's going to go and if she's going to keep the apartment in Switzerland and what's happening with her son and her sister's kids and all the other stupid stuff that go on in both our lives. In the limousine, she hands me something in Kleenex. It was the day here I'm with her with the Benny Carter. Where's the picture of me? And now here it is, right here. Carter, me and Ella. That was the day she hands me this piece of Kleenex, puts it in my hand, and she says, look, when you get home, you open this and we'll talk about it. So, get to the airport, watch her leave, get home, open the Kleenex. It's a diamond bracelet. Okay, well, look, maybe something's loose and she wants to have it fixed. I take it to Leon, our jeweler on 47th Street. Show him the bracelet. He looks and says, Phoebe, this doesn't even look like it was ever worn. There's nothing wrong with it. The lock is perfect. There are no stones. Stones are loose. It's not. It's pretty ugly. Where'd you buy it? I says, it's Ella's. So he says, let's call her up and find out what we should do with it. I said, all right. I called her. Ella, this is Phoebe. What do you want? That's just how she would be. She'd get high and low. I said, I'm here with Leon, and I got the bracelet here. She said, don't bother me with that. I don't want it. It's for you. And she hung up on me.
That was it.
That was Ella.
Yeah.
Unbelievable lady.
So at that time you were working at Basin Street?
When I got that?
Yeah.
I don't think I was working any place.
So you were married to Lou Jacobs. And you were living here in the apartment. And you knew Ella.
Oh, I think I was working with Louis Armstrong on his private deal on a foundation and stuff. I think I quit the nightclub.
Now, how did you meet?
I was working in Rockefeller Center. That's what I was doing. I got Nelson Rockefeller had me open a room, the Rainbow Grill, where he wanted music, and the Rainbow Room and the Rainbow
Grill. Once you got a profession, your profession was booking musicians, finding them, getting to know them, and finding a place for them.
I was an expert in hot air and bullshit.
But it worked. That's
it paid off.
It paid off. Now, how did you meet Louis Armstrong?
Decca. That was my first day at Decca. They gave me music to go in the recording studio. So I put a piece on the piano, the drum, bass, everybody put out the music. I didn't have a trumpet part. Walked back in the office and I said, I lost the trumpet part to Mr. Armstrong. And everybody cracks up, laughing.
He didn't have
with that, he walks in, and they say, Pops, She lost the trumpet part. She didn't hear part. He cracks up. I became the girl that lost his music. But what they didn't tell me is that nobody ever wrote a piece of music for him. He listened to it and he improvised.
Yeah. Mm. And so, I'm trying to think, was this was in the 50s or the 60s?
Was in Decca in the 50s.
In the 50s. So it was 50s that you really got to know a lot of these people.
It started. It had to be a whole bunch of experience. I mean, I didn't really get tight with Ella until I got to answer the phone when her sister was dying.
Yeah.
And they called me. She says, she told the operator from the hospital, whenever you call the club, you ask for Miss Phoebe. Mm-hmm. She'll know where I am and she'll mm-hmm. take the message. Mm-hmm. So she would trust me with little mm-hmm. confidences. Mm-hmm. So I got the message that her sister died. Mm-hmm. When I went in to tell her, I waited till after the show was over and everything, and I said, Ella, I'm ready to go to Philadelphia with you. Your sister passed.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew mm-hmm. she was going to go to Philadelphia, mm-hmm. and I didn't want her to go alone.
Yeah. Yeah.
So she says, you go with me? Mm-hmm. I said, well, I like Philadelphia. I said, I got to watch him. Bailey Banks and Biddles. She threw something at me.
Yeah.
Because I didn't want to make her feel like that.
Yeah.
But we never went because the next morning she said, look, I have to work. I have 5 kids I have to worry about. My mm-hmm. sister's got 5 kids.
Mm-hmm.
So you make all the arrangements, talk to the funeral directors, mm-hmm. and I'll pay all the bills. And mm-hmm. And I did everything for her.
So of the musicians that you knew in all those years, uh-huh. was Ella your closest friend? Who else were you very close to?
Peggy Lee.
Mm-hmm.
Sarah Vaughan.
Mm.
I traveled with Sarah. I got Sarah her record contract that she hadn't recorded for 8 years.
Mm.
I got a $10,000 advance and a commitment of 3 LPs with Clayton Thomas.
And when I saw you a couple weeks ago, you were with Nat Cole's brother.
Yeah.
Did you know Nat Cole?
Yeah. I told you about Nat Cole being Billie Holiday's accompanist.
Right.
In Kelly's.
Right.
He never sang when he was there.
Yeah.
It was only the night that Billie got sick that Ralph made him sing.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote about it in his autobiography. Uh-huh. That was the first night he ever sang.
Yeah. Tell me, I'll put this in a little earlier, but tell me on 52nd Street, tell me some of the music places. What were the names of them and how were they?
The restaurant that we all used to go to was the Hickory House.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where Billy Taylor and Marion McPartlin played.
Mm.
The music was above the bar.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it was very awkward, but very nice. And it had great food.
Mm-hmm.
And Popkin owned it.
Mm-hmm.
And John Popkin, and I used to go there a lot with Duke Ellington.
Mm-hmm.
He loved the kosher calf's liver. And also Mr. Glazer used to go there, Joe Glazer from Associated Booking, who handled mm-hmm. Louis. And across the street was Kelly Stable. Then there was the Yacht Club,
mm-hmm.
where a very famous quartet was introduced in New York. I forget them now. And then the next, there was the Club Samoa. There was the Famous Door. There was the Three Deuces. There was Zombies, I think.
And all those places were playing jazz.
Oh, one on top of the other. And you could go to the bar for 50 cents for a beer and hear all the music. It was so out of this world.
Mm-hmm.
And New Year's Eve, the street would like be closed and you'd walk in the gutter and everybody would be friendly, like New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody would talk to everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
You never got it. Nobody was hit on the head. I didn't know of any problems.
Mm-hmm.
The House of Chan was the Chinese restaurant on 6th Avenue that a lot of us used to meet if you wanted to go for good Chinese. There was a place across the street from the House of Chan called Pick and Chicken or something like that, a pick a rib.
We were talking about Tommy Flanagan and Ellis Larkins. Let me ask you, who are the other great piano players that you've met?
Errol Garner,
yeah.
Dave Brubeck. My Ralph Watkins introduced Dave Brubeck for the first time in New York. Errol Garner, Dave Brubeck, Canadian Sunset, Eddie Haywood,
uh-huh.
Dorothy Donegan,
How about
Hank Jones?
UB Blake at that time was not playing.
Oh, he didn't go. I only met UB Blake when he was 86 years old working in Carnegie Hall.
Yeah.
I met him through Duke Ellington.
Yeah, he was something.
Oh, UB was divine. He was a class act. He was the classiest man I know.
But I'm trying to think of the very famous piano player, died young, black. Everybody looked up to him. Let me stop this a second until I remember.
You see, you got to understand, you asked me Thelonious Monk. For me, I could only be friendly, people would respond to me and I'd respond to them, that I could have something in common with. There had to be something that would draw us together, like a portable radio that picks up some airwaves.
Yeah.
And Thelonious Monk wasn't for me. He was like a kook, like that other, that guy, Miles Davis.
Oh, yeah.
And he turned his backside to the audience and scratches his ass. And no, I couldn't get friendly with these people. Or Lenny Bruce.
Yeah.
I mean, he worked in the club.
Yeah.
I would just do my job and do whatever I had to do. But the people that I could see some bit of warmth and humanity to, I sought them out, or I made them feel that
Did you get to know Billie Holiday?
Well, as much as any you can learn, know anybody that's drugged up,
Yeah. I saw her do a midnight jazz concert when I was 15 years old at the Sheridan Theater in the Village, and she came on after the Modern Jazz Quartet. They played for an hour. She came on at 1 o'clock in the morning and just brought the house down.
All right, I'm going to tell you. You asked me, do you know? I said to somebody, yes, I know them. But ask them if they know me.
Uh-huh.
Now, I'm sitting in the Blue Note last week.
Uh-huh.
James Moody, I know for 35 years.
Uh-huh.
Who sits next to me, who comes in to sit next to me, is Bill Cosby, Camille, and Ed Lewis from Essence magazine and his wife.
Uh-huh.
They sit down. Bill Cosby had asked me to be his witness when he meant to marry Camille in Elkton, Maryland. He was working at Basin Street East.
Uh-huh.
Bill Cosby used to see me all the time in UB Blake's house.
Mm-hmm.
He called me up to ask me what I should get. He should get them for Christmas.
Uh-huh.
Did I know Bill Cosby?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. He's sitting there. James Moody goes over to Bill Cosby and he says to Bill, don't you know who's sitting there? Phoebe. So Bill goes like that. Mm-hmm. He says to Camille, you don't remember Phoebe? Camille comes over and she said, oh, I'm sorry. I said, you did get married in Elkton, Maryland, didn't you? And I mean, when do I say you're going to remember me? I mean, you meet so many people, I know you wouldn't remember me. Now you're asking me, how do you know?
That's a different person.
Now,
different
stars
type of person.
Are very funny.
Yeah.
They don't remember.
Well, the good ones do.
Now, look it. If I tell you that I met this man in UB Blake's house, when I took UB Blake to the Johnny Carson show, Bill Cosby's office would call, we're going to have Mr. Cosby's chauffeur pick you up in L.A., and you're staying with Mr. Cosby in his house.
Yeah.
I said, you know, UB Blake will not do that. He wants to go to a hotel.
Yeah.
We thank you very much. Yeah. I mean, they knew me. They saw me.
Yeah.
You know, this is ridiculous.
UB Blake, I saw at the Lucille Lortel Theater in the Village, Theater d'Elise. And he was playing with Dick Hyman. A guy, was there a good white piano player named Walton or something like that? I think it was his name. And UB was playing, and he was kidding. He got up and he said, now those are my protégés, and I'm going to sit down and play. And he was damn near 100 at that time. And I think he lived almost to 100, didn't he?
Yeah, he lived 101.
101. And he sat down and he started playing. I never heard anything like it. He played
his
things.
His fingers.
Huge fingers. But besides that, he had such style.
Yeah.
He sang some of the songs that he and... there was a songwriter that was that they wrote operas together.
Noble Sissel.
Yeah, and he played. He said, I get emotional even when I tell you this. He said, I'm going to play a song that people don't like because they think it's not good about black people. It's called Shine. He said, but I like it. There wasn't a dry eye in the house.
Oh, the man was—he was such an experience. Well, he called Lou and he said he called my husband boy. Loved him. Said, "Boy, what are you doing the first weekend in April, whatever?" Lou said, "I don't know what I'm doing tomorrow, Yubi. What do you need? And you tell me what you need, you got it." He said, "I want you to go with me to Washington." Well, we'll talk Sunday. We used to see them every Sunday. Because my mother died. They adopted us. Because we used to go to my mother's every Sunday. And they said, "Every Sunday you come up to our house." So we're out to Yubi's on Sunday, and he shows us a wire that he got from President Reagan to come to the White House. He's getting Medal of Freedom. And Yubi and Marion want to take Lou and I with them. So Lou said, "Look, you know, Yubi, we love you. But you and Marion have friends much longer than you know Phoebe and I. We understand if you want to take somebody. We understand." So Yubi puts up his bony finger to Lou and he says, "Listen, boy, it's the quality of a relationship that matters, not the quantity.
Yeah.
You better get your ass ready to come with me."
And you did.
Takes us to Washington,
D.C. Isn't that wonderful? Wonderful. So now, let's come to the present time. Your husband passed away how long ago?
89.
And who do you became the head of the Louis Armstrong Foundation?
No, I'm not the head. I'm the executive vice president.
Okay. How did that come about?
Well, when Louis Armstrong in 1969 told me that he wanted to arrange a luncheon for his lawyer and his wife and his agent and so forth to do whatever it is what he wanted to do, and he started a foundation. And in his foundation, I asked him why he's doing it. He said, "I want to give back to the world some of the goodness I got. And I want you to help me. It's going to be music and education." So he appointed his own board. He didn't put me on the board. Evelyn Cunningham, who's 96 and still very much alive, a dynamite lady you should meet. She's still alive and on the board. Oscar Cohn is the only other one on the board. And when the foundation really became active, he appointed David Gold, the head of it, to handle his finances and everything else. I don't know how it happened that Mr. Gold asked me to be the executive vice president, and well, we got it all together.
So what I'm asking you about...
It had to be 52, I think, 53.
Okay, so Milton gave you the rush, they met your parents, and you married him in 52.
Maybe it was 60. No,
it couldn't have been 60s. Your son was bar mitzvahed in 49.
Right.
That first husband didn't want to pay for the bar mitzvah.
Right,
and
Mac and Molly Eichenbaum were the guys that really made the bar mitzvah for the kids.
Okay, so when you married the second time...
When I married Milton, he called me up and he says, "Take off from work. We'll go to Elton, Maryland."
Were your kids grown then?
No, they weren't grown. My daughter was maybe 15, 16.
So what year was she born? She was born like 40?
She's 3 years younger than her brother.
So 40, 41?
Yeah.
So 15, it'd be 55, 56.
Yeah, well, that would have been, that would have been it.
So,
I went to Elton, Maryland, and we got married.
Yeah.
And he came home to my apartment. I was living at 9611 63rd Drive in Rego Park. And he came home, and my father was living with me then. I forgot my father had that problem with the Kefauv Investigating Committee and that whole thing. And I had a bedroom for myself with two beds in it, and my children had a room, and my father used to sleep in my kid's room. And when I married Milton, and my father wanted to look him over, he looked him, never looked anybody straight in the face that he didn't like. He gave him one of those slanty looks, you know, like a real look.
He had him figured out. He had him figured out right from the beginning.
He said, "Black suede shoes." he didn't have to say anything after that, because my father was a man of few words, anyhow. So he had to leave. My father had something came up. because I was a wreck, because Bessie Flowers was my housekeeper then, and she knew that my father was in a lot of trouble because he was, kind of broke, and he wouldn't accept anything from me, even though I had a lot of money that he gave me. He used to give me cash.
Yeah.
And he used to put it away in the vault, and I figured one of these days, my old man's going to really need it, and I'm going to help him out, which I eventually did when he had his deportation trial. So Milton, so we married, and then Milton used to travel for Cotton Club Frocks, which was his father's business. And in
that was a garment business.
What was it called? Cotton Club Frocks, one of the biggest.
Oh, you mentioned that before.
Biggest cotton club manufacturers of dresses in the United States.
Yeah, you mentioned that, and you said that they had something called a swirl.
That was one. They had a trademark on swirl. So they had a factory in Frocks.
Frocks, okay.
They had a factory in outside of Philadelphia, one in Jersey, I think. And Milton used to travel for them.
Mm-hmm.
So after we were married several days and we had no honeymoon or anything, he had to go on a trip.
Mm-hmm.
While he's away on the trip, the doorbell rings in my house, and there's two men that are coming in to take my baby grand piano, whatever possessions I have, and I want to know what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And they show me some identification and tell me that he's behind in his support of his two children.
This is right a week or two after you married him.
A week or two after I married to him. And I called my mother instantly, and she said, "I'll be right over you. Hold those guys there." And whatever. She got very excited, and John will straighten them out.
Yeah.
So they came
Who
over.
Who was John?
John was my mother's husband. He was in Numbers and a Shylock. And he was one of these guys, you know.
Was he Jewish or Italian?
Italian. Oh, my God. He was real. He could have written The Sopranos. He was unbelievable. The only thing is he never used bad language in front of us. Yeah. It was The Sopranos, I think, were an exaggeration. Yeah. Italian men didn't talk that way in front of the people they loved. Anyway, he and Mom came out, and my mother said, "I bought this piano for my daughter when she was 6 years old. And this mink coat my husband bought her last year. I mean, these are her possessions. This guy has got a naked ass." She said, "I didn't care for him in the first place. And he's a phony," and, you know, she went on and on and on. But she didn't want to make me too miserable, but she got rid of the guys for me, and she straightened them out. Then Donna called his ex-wife after she found out that...
Whose ex-wife?
Milton Sharpman's ex-wife.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
She lived two blocks from my mother in Scarsdale.
Uh-huh.
And she called to say she did not know that these people were going to come, that she doesn't know me, but she heard that I'm a very nice lady and we have a lot in common, since I'm also a divorced woman with two children.
Mm-hmm.
And she certainly didn't want to make life...
Difficult.
She sounded perfect. But she says, after all, his father is a millionaire. She said, "I don't know if you know how rich the Shoffmans are."
Mm-hmm.
She said, "And Milton gets paid very, very well. I mean, at least he could do with $100 the week that he's supposed to give me for the kids."
Mm-hmm.
"I don't know anything about it." She says, "Well, watch out, because he'll gamble on anything."
And you didn't know that before.
Oh, how would I know?
I didn't know.
My friends only knew that he danced well,
and
he was handsome, honey.
So how long were you married to him?
On and off 6 months, because he would come back and I'd throw him out, and then he'd come back and he'd cry, and then we went to a marriage council, and then we went to a psychiatrist, and when the last time when I went to the psychiatrist, it was like 88 degrees out, and I had a scarf on my neck because I had marks all over my neck from his fingers.
Oh, yeah.
He went to choke me.
Yeah.
He found the bonds in the drawer that was my father's, and he said, "If you don't get me that money, I'm going to turn your father into the district attorney." And he says, "Because I know how you got that cash."
Yeah.
Your father was doing blue stamps or gas stamps. I mean, he was hallucinating about my father.
Yeah.
My father was not a dog, but he was not a gangster in the sense that he wasn't involved with the dope or prostitution or killing people.
Yeah.
I mean, the most I ever saw my father do is punch somebody in the nose. But I mean, I admit he must have been a tough guy because he grew up in the survival of the fittest.
Sure. So you were only married to
About 6 months.
About 6 months.
Yeah.
Okay. After that, how did you meet Lou?
Oh.
Because you didn't have that in the story before.
Well, after
you told me the story how you went down to
Virgin Islands.
But before that, you knew him somehow.
Before that, I knew him 7 years before I married him.
Mm-hmm.
My friend Helen Barrow was vice president in charge of production at Simon & Schuster.
Right.
And she used to give me freelance work.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that.
I used to do the puzzle boxes,
right. Yeah.
Crossword puzzle. You have to be a genius to fill in the black squares. And I worked for her, and she had a boyfriend by the name of Dutch Heineman, who was the brother of Mrs. Richard L. Simon.
Oh, Simon & Schuster.
Simon & Schuster. Mm-hmm. Carly Simon was his niece,
yeah.
Joanne Simon, and Lucy Simon. And Dutch was a fantastic gentleman. I adored him.
Dutch Heineman was the husband?
He was just a boyfriend. Helen Gelber divorced Ben Gelber when she...
Right.
Whole other story. But she started to go with Dutch when she met him at a Christmas party of Simon & Schuster's,
mm-hmm.
and she was a rock that chick.
Yeah.
She was Paulette Goddard and Sophia Loren, I mean, built and everything, and also very sexy,
mm-hmm.
even though she had a standoffish way about her because her father died when she was 13 and she was horribly poor,
mm-hmm.
and I guess she had to be very...
How did you meet her?
Helen and I met at a dance at the Tabs.
East Tremont Avenue.
When Leona came back from Europe after she had that romance with the West Point cadet, and she was very depressed, and I took her to this dance. Helen Barrow, Helen at that time, her maiden name is Barrow, right? Helen Barrow was then going with Ben Gelber. And Ben Gelber was
a friend of
Dave Kars and Carl Ostrow.
Got the whole picture.
So that's how we became friends. And then in later years, when I moved to 9611, Helen Barrow lived on the fifth floor. I lived on the fourth floor.
In Regal Park.
In Regal Park, right.
Let me stop
I'll let it go.
Okay. So, I want to stop it. I'll stop it. Who was it? I'm starting up again.
So where were we just now?
We were meeting Lou.
No. So Dutch Heineman says to Helen and I both, "Oh, have I got a guy for you?" So I said, "Dutch, I've had it. I mean, my experience with Milton has been so horrendous." Well, of course, my lawyer introduced me to another guy that I became engaged with.
Harry. That's in the story.
Okay. Yeah. No, it was another
Harry
guy.
Harry Rosenblum, the guy you...
Harry
were...
Rosenblum was my uncle's friend that he did business with in liquor. The guy that I got involved with right after the divorce from Milton was Ben Rosenfeld. I was in Tootch Shores with my lawyer when he gave me the final papers for the divorce, and he said to me, "Stick around, I want you to meet somebody who's here to see my fair lady, and he doesn't have a date." Well, I was dying to go. I saw my fair lady, but I waited, and I was living in Scarsdale then, so I met Ben Rosenfeld, and he was very nice. Immediately, he wanted to take me to the theater, and we hit it off very well. And after a couple of weeks, he proposed marriage to me, and he took me to Milwaukee to meet his family and all this other stuff. And I decided, whatever happened. So after, when Helen Dutch knew about this, that I almost got married to this guy in Milwaukee, and I was going to go out there with my kids, and Dutch was saying, "Listen, I got a New York guy for you. He's out of sight. The one thing you're going to love about him is he's got more jazz records than you have."
Isn't that funny? Yeah.
And it was true.
Yeah.
Lou had a collection of Jimmy Lunsford and Erskine Hawkins and Billy Eckstein and Billy Daniels and stuff I didn't have.
Yeah.
So she said she's making a party because Frank, cute musician, had sent her a suckling pig. And she Frank, musician, was a publisher or something that she did, printer that she did business with. And every year he used to send her some gargantuan present, like a big goose or a big ham.
Yeah.
This year he sent her the suckling pig. She said, "I'm making a suckling pig party. I don't know how to cook it, so I hired a West Indian guy who's going to come over and do it." So she didn't tell me that she's got a guy for me, or Dutch didn't say anything, but the party was at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I was living in Scarsdale on my mother's, And I came to the party, and they told Lou that the most attractive brunette at the party is for him. It was a very attractive brunette at the party, but it wasn't me. I mean, Pauline could knock me right off a loop.
Yeah.
She was a fantastic-looking lady, and built and dressed and very flirtatious. And she and Lou hit it off until her husband got there. And when her husband got there, she gave him the chill. So I don't know if he ever got connected with her or whatever. But after the party was over, about 5, 6 o'clock, Dutch and Helen didn't want the party to end. So they knew that Tommy Dorsey was playing at the Statler.
Where was the Statler at that time?
At the 33rd Street, across the street from Pennsylvania Station.
Not the Pennsylvania Hotel.
Yeah, that was...
Oh, that was the Pennsylvania... Statler was the Pennsylvania, yeah.
Right, and
yeah.
Tommy Dorsey was playing there, and they knew I loved Tommy Dorsey.
Uh-huh.
So they said, come on, let's all go over there. It was only 8 of us.
Yeah.
So it was Lou and I were a couple.
What year do you think that was, roughly?
In the 50s.
Yeah.
50s.
Yeah.
I think because I gave him Simon & Schuster Circle 56400 as my telephone number.
Uh-huh.
And so about a month before he got sick, he had that piece of paper in his wallet.
Oh,
he never threw
beautiful.
It away. And so we went and we danced, and I was wearing a cincher. You know how boys would say, push your boobies up and you look. So I was wearing this cincher, and he said to me, I'd love to dance with you when you haven't got this armor on. So I said to Helen, this guy is a wise guy. And, men are not for me anymore. I've had it. I've had it up to here with them all. She didn't say anything further, but that Saturday, Lou called me up and he said, I'm playing tennis up in New Rochelle or wherever. I'd love to take you for lunch. So I said, I spend Sunday with my children. She said, I'd like to take you all for lunch.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it seemed to me like a good idea. My kids could have used male companionship, but he was like a wholesome guy, you know, he'd never been married, and he was asking me my kids like ice skating and bicycling. So I said, all right, we'll go. And my kids flipped for him. And even for them, in fact, they hardly paid attention to me at all. And from that, we developed a relationship. It was strictly friendship. I mean, I don't think that Lou and I exchanged an intimacy of a kiss or a hug. Maybe I knew him about a year.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I met Lou.
Okay, and so you were friendly with him in a social way.
Platonic
way for years.
No, I would say no. We got intimate. We had exchanged.
But now, when you went down to when you went down to Virgin Islands with Harry Rosenblum,
right?
At that time, Lou had been your boyfriend, but there were no commitments.
Never. He never said anything to me.
Yeah, because you mentioned that.
And I would have never said anything to him for the last thing in my life.
So you were friends, you were lovers, but there was no...
I would have loved to hear him say, as my mother said, he's not housebroken. Get somebody that's...
So then we picked up the story because then you went down to...
Harry Rosenblum was building me this house in Virgin Islands.
Okay, so we'll stop right there. So you were happily married to Lou for many years.
His whole life.
Now, tell me when he passed away and what were the circumstances and so forth.
Lou died in, I think, 87 or 88.
Mm-hmm.
And I denoted some things about him as we were living together with regard to his holding his head on the side to see... If you're driving a car, you kind of look straight out at something. It seemed to me that maybe there was something wrong with peripheral. I didn't know what it was. And Lou was not the kind of a guy that you could pull around.
Mm-hmm.
He was extremely devoted to me and my family. He was the most giving, loyal, generous, caring human being I've ever known, with more style and grace than I could ever imagine. I mean, here's a man, my mother had no hospitalization when she went to the hospital. He got my mother a private room, nurses around the clock, paid all the bills, and never once said to me, what I do for your family.
Yeah.
Never said a word.
Yeah.
I mean, that was Lou.
Yeah.
When it came time to take Susie's kids, well, Susie's husband and she split, the two little babies. He'd take the boys into Barney's, dress them from top to bottom. When they had to go to school, put them in private school. There was no two-way. I mean, this was not a man that was a rich man.
Yeah.
His father had a little hardware store.
Yeah, you might say I got that.
College Point.
Yeah.
And they used to live in back of the store.
Yeah.
And then they bought the little house, and then that's where he was raised.
Yeah.
So Lou didn't know. Money in shoeboxes like you don't believe. Only cash he had.
Yeah.
Because when he gave me all the cash, yeah, I spent everything I had on him when he got sick. I stopped at nothing. In fact, the carpets are all up here and all the drapes, and I had all the furniture in storage and made this room a hospital room.
Yeah. So what did he have?
He had a tumor of the brain that Dr. Joseph Ranzahoff operated on him before me, way before
where?
Me. The tumor of the brain?
No. Where? What hospital?
NYU.
NYU.
New York. That was the day I called Benny Goodman to tell Mr. Goodman that Lou is diagnosed and I can't get this Dr. Ranzahoff. Mm-hmm. And Benny says, who the hell is he? I don't know him. But I knew Benny was very close to Dr. Arthur LaCalio, who was the head of surgery.
Mm-hmm.
Benny said, where are you, Phoebe? I said, I'm in a telephone booth. He said, give me the number. I gave him the number. Mm-hmm. Go put Muriel on. Give her the number. I got the number. I waited in the phone booth. It took 15 minutes. Mr. Goodman has Muriel call me back. Tomorrow morning at 9:30, go over to Bellevue on the fourth floor, operating room, da-da-da, waiting mm-hmm. room. Dr. Ranzahoff will see you.
Yeah.
Saw him. I brought with me the MRIs that they got, yeah, and he said, bring your husband in tomorrow. 3 months, he told me, and when I called the office, I'd have to wait.
Yeah.
I brought Lou in and he operated on Lou. As a result of the operation, Lou lost his ability to swallow.
Mm.
So it was touch and go. It was terrible. I don't remember. Lou was about 4 years older than me.
So it was in 80, it was 20 years.
But we discovered this through this man that's writing the book on me. Hugh Wyatt was a writer for the Daily News, and he had done an expo on ophthalmologists and optometrists.
Mm-hmm.
And Lou was having so much trouble with his eyes, I denoted, that I took him to Boston, where I took Ella Fitzgerald to Dr. Smithwick, who was the head of the Ophthalmology Institute in the Boston Hospital. And he told me that Lou had some peripheral problems. And then it was all as a result of this, of these examinations of going back and forth with his eyes, till we got him an MRI. And then after his operation, we had him in Rusk Institute, adjacent to the hospital.
Rehab,
and I hired his own therapist that would be with him constantly. And Lou did not talk to me.
Mm-hmm.
He'd look at me and I'd like, with love and pity and shame,
mm-hmm.
and he'd break my heart.
Mm.
Well, in that period, I lost 40 pounds, and I was drinking.
Mm-hmm.
I never allowed the nurses to cook any food. They had to go in there and eat, because his bed was here, mm-hmm. and the nurse's cot was there, mm-hmm. and there was a toilet,
mm-hmm.
and I just couldn't bear that, because he was fed through his abdomen,
mm-hmm.
and I wasn't skilled to be able to feed him.
Sure.
So I had registered nurses around the clock,
mm-hmm.
and when it got to a point where the doctor said, look, he needs a place where there's some better care than just
mm-hmm.
this,
mm-hmm.
that we got him into the Riverdale Nursing Home.
Mm-hmm.
And there I also had attendance for him,
mm-hmm.
nurse's aides, but he was in the hospital wing. And I'd visit him every day. And he had his own private room overlooking the Hudson. And I'd bring nice clothes.
Sure. He knew you when you got there.
He was alert. He was alert.
But he couldn't talk?
I don't think he wanted to talk.
Yeah.
I really don't think so. Because Lou at his best was not flowery.
Mm-hmm.
If I'd say to him, Lou, how do I look?
Mm-hmm.
He says, come on, stop the bullshit, let's go. No, I'd say, Lou, why can't you tell me something? Come on now, will you get lost? You know,
yeah.
he was always very the tough guy.
Yeah.
He wanted to be Well, he came from this European background. Yeah. His mother and father were that way. I don't think they ever told him they loved him.
Yeah.
I said, you never told me you loved me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was, before I went to bed with him, I thought to myself, Jesus, I don't know what's going to go on with this guy. He doesn't register anything. I mean, what may I ought to get him a bell or a horn so I'll know what's happening. So he was the kind that he just did not, he also was very private.
Yeah.
And he didn't like demonstrations. Like when I would go over and sit on his lap, say, now, come on. Yet I know he loved me.
Yeah.
I could feel he cared about me. I could feel by the way he treated me and my family.
Yeah.
How caring he was. He was beautiful. Yeah. And he was a very... he was a warm guy that had a lot of humility and a lot of class and style.
And he eventually passed away.
Right. And I tell you, when Ella Fitzgerald met him, now he was not a stage door Johnny. I had a fight with him, come meet me at the club, and I got to do this. And that. But it was Ella's birthday, so he went and he got her something, and he brought it in and he gave it to her. And she just flipped for him. The two of them were giggling, and she was telling her about Erskine Hawkins or some other record that he had that he loved her to hear. And she said to me, oh, this guy is delicious. She said, if it wasn't your boyfriend, I'd be on the make for him.
That's sweet. And he finally passed.
Yeah.
Yeah, up at the hospital there?
No, I took him to Mount Sinai.
Yeah.
And when I brought him into Mount Sinai, the emergency room, I never felt so alone in my life. And I went and waited for the ambulance, and Dr. Lebowitz, I called him and I said, Arthur, they tell me not to put him on any life supports or whatever, whatever. And Arthur said, Phoebe, you have to let them put him on life support, otherwise I know you'll never be able to live with yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So I did what he told me. I said, Arthur, come. He said, if I thought I could do something, I'd come.
Mm-hmm.
I said, how could you let me be here alone? He said, you're not alone.
Mm-hmm.
Take care of it, you're strong. And when I went into the room and when he expired, and I touched he had wonderful feet with his toes. I touched his toes, and I said, Lou, you're never going to leave me. And walked out, went into the elevator, and there I meet a man who is the brother of my very dear friend, Muriel Zuckerman, who was Benny Goodman's right hand.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, Arnold, what are you doing here? He says, I'm just visiting Muriel. I said, Muriel, what is she doing here? He said, you know, her Alzheimer's got much worse.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to put her in the hospital. So I just walked the street that night and called Lou's sister. You know, she broke down because they had a tremendous attachment to one another. And his father had, Lou had bought a plot out in Long Island. Like he's got about 20 graves. I got about 18 graves there. And, you know, I don't know who's ever going to use them, but that's what we did.
And you moved on.
And I moved on, yeah. And I guess I did feel that Lou was always with me.
Yeah, beautiful.
I really felt that way.
Yeah.